All right. Hello, and welcome everyone to another episode of Scoliosis Dialogues, your official SRS podcast and videocast. My name is John Voorhees, and I am speaking to you today from Stanford, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Terry Ishmael from Philadelphia. And we are here today to discuss some of the research that was presented at SRS this year. We have a special guest today, Bahar Shahidi, who's from San Diego. And she's going to talk to us today about her award-winning paper. So she won the John Mo Best Basic Science and Translational Research Award for her E-Point poster entitled Soft Tissue Insufficiency as a Predictor for Proximal Junctional Kyphosis and Failure in Patients with Adult Spinal Deformity. So welcome on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great. So I think we wanted to just start out by introducing yourself. Why don't you tell us a little bit about where you are and what your job title is?
Sure. I am currently an associate professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at UC San Diego. I originally did my training in my undergrad at Berkeley and then went on to get my physical therapy degree. And in a past life, I was a physical therapist. I practiced for about 10 years in outpatient spine, focusing on chronic spine pain. And then I went on to get my PhD in neurophysiology and a postdoctorate fellowship in muscle and tissue physiology. So now that kind of has come full circle to really applying my work into tissue physiology and biomarkers for poor clinical outcomes in a variety of spine populations.
What really spurred you to make this change?
A change from physical therapy or neurophysiology or all of the above? No.
Along the way, it sounds like you had a clinical practice in physiotherapy, then you decided to go back to school, and here you are presenting on spinal deformity surgery.
Yeah, so I mean, I think part of it was, I was practicing throughout my education, so I was practicing at the same time as I was doing my PhD, so it was a little bit not consecutive. It was a lot of it was happening in parallel, and I always wanted to kind of be involved in the academic part of things, even from the beginning of when I started practicing. So I don't view it as much as a change as much as I do, a growth, and because I still continue to practice in rehabilitation settings, but more in the constraints of a research setting where I'm doing clinical trials or treatments in that regard. So I kind of think of it as more of a growth as opposed to a switch.
Yeah. Sounds good. Well, welcome on the podcast. We love to have perspectives from folks who aren't surgeons. We're both surgeons, but I think it's great to have different points of view from therapists and research specialists. So why don't we talk a little bit about the paper? Can you give us a quick summary of what you did and what you found?
Sure. So we have been prospectively collecting tissue and clinical data from individuals with adult spinal deformity that are getting really long construct fusions, at least four levels. And we prospectively followed them for about a year. And during their surgery, we collected tissue. Primarily, we collected ligament tissue from the UIV minus two, just so that we weren't, messing with the integrity of the tissue right at the construct or right at the junction of the construct. And we wanted to get a better sense for what the mechanics of the ligament looked like, as well as what the health of the surrounding paraspinal muscle looked like in these patients. Because I think a lot of the focus in the past and in the literature is on what the biomechanical stresses are as it relates to spinal alignment. And we were interested in informing some of the soft tissue risk factors. So we collected some ligament biopsies from consented patients that were undergoing long construct spinal fusions. And we basically did mechanical testing on those using a materials testing system, did some stress strain curves and got some stiffness measures, peak load, displacement, those types of things. And to really get a sense for what the capacity of the tissue was. And we also, in parallel, looked at imaging-based markers, primarily using the preoperative MRIs to get a sense for the size and the quality of the paraspinal muscle around the upper instrumented vertebrae. And we used those as independent predictors of development of PJK just from an angular perspective. And then also if they ended up having PJK and failure in terms of, you know, actually having to get a surgical revision associated with that failure. So those were the primary predictors that we were interested in. And we performed a series of measures in addition to the mechanical testing in the ligament. So things like measuring collagen content and glycosaminoglycans content in that ligament to understand a little bit more about the health of that ligament and how it related to the biomechanics, and understanding how that informed risk for PJK and PJF.
Sounds good. And then, so just to clarify for the audience, so you defined PJK as an increase in junctional angle of greater than 10 degrees, and proximal junctional failure was symptomatic PJK requiring revision surgery.
Exactly. So there were many people that had PJK, but it you know, just from an angular perspective, but they didn't necessarily require a revision, or they may not have even been symptomatic. So we categorized those people and the risk associated with that separately, because some people had PJK and they were totally fine clinically. And so there weren't really any, you know, further clinical requirements in terms of management. They were just kind of stable at that stage.
And so what did you find were the big predictors of PJK?
So for PJK, essentially, the predictors that we found were, you know, as you might imagine, people that had greater preoperative junctional angle were more likely to have a greater postoperative junctional angle. So that wasn't surprising to us. But what we also found was individuals that had weaker ligament. So if they had lower peak force of their ligament, they were more likely to develop PJK. And people that had, we also looked at some demographic features, just age and BMI and some of those other common features. People that had a lower BMI were also more likely to develop PJK. As it relates to PJF and those actually requiring revision surgery for their junctional kyphosis, the risk factors were paraspinal muscle atrophy and, you know, some components of the ligament composition. So in particular, the collagen to glycosaminoglycans content ratio was lower. So that kind of was another risk factor as it relates to ligament health that that caused failure, or not caused, but was associated with failure.
Where exactly did you obtain the ligament from?
The ligament was taken two levels below the planned upper instrument and vertebrae. So in all cases, you know, we didn't want to mess with the junction, because we know that interrupting the posterior ligamentous complex right at the junction might, you know, weaken that junction. So we took it two levels down because we wanted to make sure that everything else was kind of fused in place. So for all patients, we took it two levels below the upper instrumented vertebrae.
And this is supraspinous ligament?
Supraspinous and intraspinous ligament together. So we actually took it en bloc, the spinous process with its attachment to the posterior ligamentous complex, so at the superior and inferior segment. So we were able to kind of clamp at the bone and do our materials testing of the ligament in its in block kind of orientation.
That's cool. So you're testing not just the ligament strength, but also its attachment to the bone.
Right.
That's amazing. There's something that John and I had discussed a little offline was, did you consider this to be a generalized sarcopenia problem? Did you look at any other muscle groups? Because, if we have an MRI of the entire spine, the psoas is also available to be evaluated. Do you look at any correlation between those?
Yeah, that's a great question. So oftentimes what we see, so first of all, I think, you know, in general, in scoliotic patient populations, what we've found, and this is not necessarily specifically as it relates to this paper, but we consistently find that people with scoliosis, whether it's degenerative or idiopathic, have muscle atrophy. The cross-sectional area of their muscle is smaller than normally aligned individuals. And I don't think that that's as well known, particularly in, for example, adolescent idiopathic scoliosis, because people think, well, the convex side should be bigger and the concave side should be smaller just because it's because of the use profile. But in fact, those people have just in general smaller muscles, both at the level of the muscle fiber itself and at the level of the muscle compartment, the whole muscle compartment. So I do think that I don't know if atrophy is the right word for it or sarcopenia is the right word for it, because these people still have in many ways, they have maybe the appropriate amount of muscle for their condition, but there's something wrong with the way that their muscle is regenerating. So I think, and these are based on some other studies that we've done looking at the cellular characteristics and degenerative characteristics of the muscle fibers themselves, because we also have done some work in muscle biopsies looking at some of the features in that regard. So I wouldn't say it's as simple as like a disuse atrophy phenomenon or a sarcopenia phenomenon, and more a muscle degeneration phenomenon where it's actively, degrading as opposed to just not being used appropriately.
Do you think that it correlates with general sarcopenia, or is it really a local measure?
I certainly think in a subcohort of people it does. For example, and some of that has to do with the interaction between different tissue types. So for example, someone that has osteoporosis or osteopenia and a low BMI you're going to have a lot of different risk factors that play in together. It's not just sarcopenia. It's that person is underweight. They're not getting the loading of their spine that's going to induce like physiological adaptation. So their bone is weak. Their muscles are weak. Potentially even their ligament is weak. So there are multifactorial contributions to that that make a larger profile that puts someone at risk. And I think that kind of, many surgeons will describe that profile of that underweight, frail woman, older woman as being a high risk profile type of patient. And I think that this bears out in a lot of different tissue types if you look at them. But then there's also a cohort of people that are, normal BMI, maybe they have good bone even, but their soft tissue is not quite right relative to the rest of what should be going on. And I think that that's also a phenomenon that we see and we don't fully understand very well.
So what are your next?
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you, so you mentioned sort of a different set of risk factors for proximal junctional kyphosis and proximal junctional failure. And I thought that was a little bit confusing because I sort of think that the PJF patient should just sort of be the worst of the PJK. So why did you have an entirely different set of the predictors? What do you think?
Part of that I think is the relationship between risk factors that predict a clinical profile versus a structural profile. And in spine, I think that's a big problem. I mean, in many cases, I'm sure you guys have seen this more than anyone, you'll have someone who has structurally a completely, torched spine, and they clinically present with very little pain or very little problems. And you can also have something on the other end of the spectrum where you have structurally a very sound spine, but the person is in a lot of pain and they have a lot of clinical symptoms. And those things don't often align in the way that we would expect them to. So it's not totally surprising to me that because oftentimes you can, ultimately the decision for revision isn't just the structural integrity, but it's also how severe someone's clinical symptoms are and how ready they are for, how willing they are to maintain their current symptom level and if they're okay with that. And those predictors are oftentimes very different than what's just happening structurally. So it doesn't totally surprise me, but it definitely, I would think that they would at least overlap a little bit or be inclusive of each other at some level, but they don't seem to be. But there's also a sample size issue here too. We have a much smaller cohort of patients with failure than we do with kyphosis. And so it could be that we just need to get a little bit more sample size in there to be confident in those predictors.
Very interesting. Like, so what do you think is the next step for your project? Like, how are we going to, you know, put this into clinical use? How are spinal deformity surgeons really going to incorporate this into their practice and their decision making?
Well, I think there are a couple of obvious action items here. The first one is, I think people are already starting to, or and have for many years, utilized things like ligament tethering and augment some like simple augmentation procedures to try to mitigate prophylactically some of the failures that they see in that regard. So I think providing some information about who that might be an appropriate strategy for is an easy target based on this data. Can we identify the right patient to do ligament augmentation with, for example? That's something I think is very reasonable that could come out of these data. The second is from a perspective of the muscle, I think people probably underestimate how intentional you have to be about conservative management from the prehabilitation perspective. And of course, I'm biased in this regard because I'm a physical therapist, but but I think that a lot of times people come into the option of surgery with this failed conservative management kind of checkbox, but really paying attention to whether that conservative management was actually attending to the planned region, that regardless of whether you decide you're going to do surgery, if you're planning on having an upper instrument vertebrae at, you know, T4, maybe you should be telling someone, a therapist or whoever, to do prehab at that region to try to fortify it. So in the understanding that that area is going to be your new biomechanical workhorse. So if you're thinking about it that way, as opposed to I'm going to have this person go through conservative management, which means they're going to try to address the pain generator, which is oftentimes much lower, then you're not necessarily aligning those two goals and plans in a way that could optimize someone's recovery. So I think that's another potential area where if the surgeon understands that that's what they're going to do regardless, then maybe you can give a rehab specialist a little bit more direction in, you know, focus on this area so that I can get the best tissue health out of this area that's now going to be, you know, under a lot more stress so that they have potentially better chances for recovery.
Targeted prehab. I like that. That was another thing I learned at SRS. You know, Michelle Wellborn gave a great talk about pain in adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. And patients experiencing sort of periscapular shoulder blade pain after fusions that go up into the thoracic spine. And she suggested some early work that maybe some prehab might be able to strengthen those muscles and decrease pain post-op. So I like what happened into the practice.
Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, when you talk to these folks that have been doing this forever, Larry Lanky and some of these, you know, people that have great outcomes. If you talk to them about the way that they have their program structured, oftentimes these multidisciplinary programs are very strictly implemented. And I think that a lot of times that ends up kind of getting brushed under the rug as it relates to understanding why these people get such great outcomes. It's more than just one thing. Incorporating the whole care, directing the care paradigm from all the way from that initial, you know, surgical plan, prehab, surgical prep, and then what you do intraoperatively and in your hands as a surgeon is just one part of it. And making sure that you're kind of optimizing each potential component is a big piece. And I think that that's something that we could do a better job of attending to.
Well, great. John, do you have any other questions?
No, thanks very much. Congratulations on your award.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. This was fascinating. We definitely learned a lot, and I'm sure that our viewers did as well. We're just going to wrap up this episode of Scoliosis Dialogues. Thanks so much for Joining us, Dr. Shahidi, and from my co-presenter myself, we want to say thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Scoliosis Research Society is a nonprofit professional organization made up of physicians and allied health personnel. Their primary focus is on providing continuing medical education for healthcare professionals and on funding and supporting research in spinal deformities. Please visit srs.org for further information.